It is 3 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
The United States considers its options in case world powers fail to reach a nuclear deal with Iran by Monday. And a veteran Tunisian politician emerges as a frontrunner in the country's landmark presidential election. I'm Michael Lippin. The United States and other world powers are considering whether to extend negotiations on curbing Iran's nuclear program past a Monday deadline. A senior U.S. official said Secretary of State John Kerry suggested extending the deadline in talks with Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif in Vienna on Sunday. The official told U.S. media that Washington is considering a range of options in case the parties fail to conclude an agreement by Monday. The United States and its partners in the talks, Britain, China, France, Germany, and Russia, are trying to reach a deal that would prevent Iran from developing a nuclear weapon. In exchange, the world powers would lift some sanctions imposed on the Iranian economy as a punishment for Iran's refusal to stop sensitive nuclear activities that could be diverted to military use. Tunisians have voted in the country's first presidential election since a 2011 pro-democracy uprising, with the two major parties preparing for a runoff vote next month. Official results had not been announced by early Monday, but the campaign manager for secular candidate Beji Caid Essebsi said the 87-year-old Nida Tunis Party veteran was the frontrunner among more than 20 candidates. Advisors to Tunisia's incumbent president and rival candidate Moncef Marzouki acknowledged that a runoff election is likely. Sunday's vote marked a major step in Tunisia's transition to democracy, which began with the 2011 overthrow of dictator Zine El Abidine Ben Ali. You're listening to VOA News. Myanmar opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi says she and her supporters will keep trying to amend a constitutional clause that bars her from running for president next year. The Nobel Peace Prize winner made the comment in an exclusive interview with the VOA Burmese service on Sunday. She said, "We never expected it to be easy, but we believed it to be possible. The question is when. The sooner we can change the constitution, the better it is for the country." Aung San Suu Kyi also said her National League for Democracy party would support a national referendum on whether to amend the constitution. The clause in question bars anyone from becoming president if they have a spouse or child that is a foreign citizen. Aung San Suu Kyi is banned because her two sons are British. Burkina Faso's military has held on to prominent positions in a new cabinet unveiled on Sunday, 3 weeks after seizing power in the midst of a popular uprising against the government. Lieutenant Colonel Isaac Zida will remain prime minister and take a new position as defense minister. His forces also will have control of the ministries of interior, territorial administration, and sports. Burkina Faso's interim civilian president, Michel Kafanada, will hold the additional post of foreign minister. Former President Blaise Compaoré was forced from power by mass protests in October after trying to amend the constitution to prolong his 27-year rule. The military, led by Colonel Zida, quickly assumed control of the country, but the African Union pressured it to cede power to a civilian president who will rule until elections in 2015. Afghan officials say a suicide bomber has killed at least 50 people at a volleyball tournament in the country's east. Sunday's match in the Paktika province district of Yahya Kel had drawn a large crowd. At least 80 people were wounded in the attack. There was no immediate claim of responsibility. Iranian authorities have granted bail to a British-Iranian woman jailed earlier this month for trying to attend a men's volleyball match despite laws banning women from male sporting events. Family members of 25-year-old Gonche Gavami say she was released on bail on Sunday ahead of an appeal. Gavami originally was detained in June after attempting to gain access to the men's volleyball match between Iran and Italy. On November 2nd, a Tehran court sentenced her to 1 year in jail for the offense of defying Iran's ruling system. Gavami is reported to be staying with her family in Tehran until the appeal court rules on her sentence. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Monday, November 24th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Nigeria's main opposition accuses the ruling PDP party of being behind a Watergate-style break-in at its Lagos office.
Why would you come and raid the data center of the political party? It's not because you want to illegally get hold of our existing strength, where we are spread, and things like that.
Lau Mohammed is a spokesman for the opposition All Progressives Congress Party. But the ruling PDP says the APC is crying wolf because it has no winnable message ahead of next year's general elections. The United Nations is expanding its Ebola response to Mali, and Sudan tells the UN mission in Darfur to get ready to leave the region.
In fact, actually, we asked them if they wouldn't stop interfering in our affairs, they have to leave. One reason is that the incapability of the keeping force to protect themselves.
Ahmed Bilal is Sudan's information minister. More political fireworks are expected during next month's Zimbabwe's ruling ZANU-PF Congress, and the African Union pledges to end child marriage in Mozambique. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Nigeria's main opposition All Progressives Congress, APC party, says security forces raided its Lagos offices over the weekend, destroying more than a dozen party computers and documents. The Nigerian State Security Service, known as the SSS, reportedly confirmed the raid, but said it was investigating an alleged duplicating of voters' cards currently being issued by the Independent Electoral Commission for next year's general election. APC spokesman Lau Mohammed likened the invasion to the U.S. Watergate scandal of the early 1970s involving President Richard Nixon. He accused the ruling People's Democratic Party, the PDP, of ordering the raid to illegally get hold of APC voter registration strength.
You may wish to remember that a couple of months ago, our party embarked on a nationwide registration exercise in which several millions of Nigerians were registered as members of our party. And we subsequently set up six centers all over the country to input and gather all the information so that we can have a database. It is one of these data offices in Lagos that we started forcibly yesterday without any court order.
So you are saying, Mr. Mohammed, that this raid, you liken it to the Watergate scandal in the United States. Are you really serious?
Absolutely, because why would you come and raid the data center of a political party? It's not because you want to illegally get hold of our registration strength, where we are spread, and things like that. And it's a very, very serious offense. There's no reason in the world why the ruling party will use the security to come and raid the data. Where sensitive information about our party is being stored in our computer. The official explanation by the government is that they had information that we were using that office to print illegal voters and the like. And our question is, why didn't you go to court and get this order to make a search? Why would you come in the middle of the night over treatment armed to the teeth, intimidating and harassing our staff and passing away our information? It's clearly something much more probably than what happened in 1972 in the U.S., Watergate scandal.
Lau Mohammed is a spokesman for the opposition All Progressives Congress, APC party. He was speaking with me from Lagos. Olisa Metu, National Publicity Secretary for the ruling PDP party, says the APC is crying wolf because it has no winnable message for the people of Nigeria ahead of the 2015 general elections.
Well, James Barclay, I have to tell you that it's an infantile reaction, a diversion from the inability of the APC to get together and put a message across the people of Nigeria. The APC has not been able
to get the message across to Nigerians and what they stand for and what they want to change from a party that sustains democracy, a party that promotes the unity of this country, to a party that believes in the vision of the country. So they've not been able to do that, and they've been engaged in the past few months, diversionary tactics, crying wolf and making cases, imaginary cases, building imaginary cases.
APC spokesman Lau Mohammed likened what he alleges happened to the Watergate scandal in the United States, saying to us that your party is trying to get information from the APC in terms of its voters' registration ahead of the elections coming next year.
Well, the Watergate scandal, I don't understand the nexus, I don't understand the relationship. But for me, first, is to establish that such a thing happened. I don't speak for the police, and I don't think the police will get any APC access. We've had security challenges in the country. Maybe there are a few people or some places that the police suspected that they were stocking arms or something will happen. And be mindful of the fact that APC has engaged in making some categorical statements on their inability to get violence or cause an uprising if they lose the election. And if the police want to find out if they are stocking arms in one or two other places, in houses that are owned by individuals, not APC offices, let us establish that fact.
Olisa Metu is the National Publicity Secretary of the ruling People's Democratic Party, the PDP of Nigeria. He spoke with me from Abuja. The United Nations Secretary General said Friday that he will open a branch of the special UN mission to fight Ebola in Mali, which has had 6 fatal cases of the virus in recent weeks. From the United Nations, viewers Margaret Bashir has more.
Ban Ki-moon spoke in Washington, where he went for talks on Ebola with the head of the World Bank and the chief of the World Health Organization. He said that while there has been progress in fighting the outbreak in West Africa, results have been uneven, and the recent emergence of a handful of cases in Mali is of particular concern. Mr. Ban announced that he had spoken with Mali's president and that the UN Mission for Ebola Emergency Response, UNMIR, would urgently establish an office in Mali.
Decisive national action combined with international support today will help to prevent a spread of the outbreak in Mali to crisis proportions tomorrow.
Mr. Ban said he was immediately dispatching to Bamako the head of the World Health Organization, Dr. Margaret Chan, and the chief of UNAIDS, Michel Sidibe, to conduct intensive discussions on how the UN system can help stop Ebola in Mali. Dr. Chan said some 500 people are being monitored for signs of the virus in Mali. They came into contact with an imam from Guinea who traveled to Bamako for treatment and then died of the disease. As of November 19th, WHO said there have been 15,145 cases of the virus, which has hemorrhagic fever-like symptoms, and 5,420 deaths. The majority of cases have been in 3 West African countries, Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. Mr. Bond said where the Ebola response strategy has been implemented, the rate of new cases appears to be slowing.
If we continue to accelerate our response, we can contain and end the outbreak by the middle of next year.
In New York, during a briefing to the UN Security Council on the Ebola response, the UN System Coordinator for Ebola, Dr. David Nabarro, said the UN will need $1.5 billion through March 2015 to cover the response effort. Currently, there is a $600 million shortfall. Dr. Nabarro told reporters the UN is making progress in reaching goals to stop the spread of Ebola. Council members expressed their support for UNMIR, their concern about the extent of the Ebola outbreak, including in Mali, and thanked countries for their contributions. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
When the ambulance comes for suspected or confirmed Ebola patients in Sierra Leone, the suited-up medics handle it as an emergency situation. This means information such as what treatment center or hospital the patient is being taken to is often left unsaid to the family members. Brahima Selu is a program manager for the International Humanitarian Aid Group, GOAL. He works to help reunite family members who have lost track of loved ones after they had been taken away by ambulance. Selu tells Ricky Shryak there are hundreds of children in Sierra Leone who currently do not know the whereabouts of their parents.
Generally, when people become infected and they are taken to the hospitals by the ambulances, there is nobody from the medical team that give information to a family regarding where they are taking their loved ones to. So you will not know which hospital, you will not know, you not have anybody to contact. So for instance, if the infected person is the father, or maybe the father and the mother, and the children are left behind, they are gone. So the children will have no information regarding where your parents are. In most cases, those parents will go and die, and the children will not even know. Two, it could be that they could take the whole family to the treatment center, and for some reason, some of the children will be contact, and they will keep them in holding centers. Now, once they are in holding centers, they don't have contact with their parents in the treatment centers any longer, and they don't have contact outside again with the other family members. So the children will just be left there. So I've just got a call this morning where a child about 3 months old is at a holding center and they don't even know the child's parents again.
What is the scale of this issue of people being lost from family members?
We have counted in our geographic location in Freetown up to 50 with no father. They were living with their fathers and they've taken their fathers to the treatment centers. They have either died or are still in treatment, but these children don't know their whereabouts.
And are these 50 children with their mothers?
No, this is the bad thing. So this one, some are with their siblings of like 21 years, 22 years, 23 years. Some are with their neighbors.
Do you have countrywide numbers?
This is very, very challenging. But according to the data we have, again, we are talking about between 288 children to like 500 in this kind of situation.
Just to be clear, these are not necessarily orphan children. These are children who the whereabouts of the parents are unknown. The parents were taken to a treatment center, and since then, the children haven't seen them, and nobody has been able to locate whether these parents passed away or whether they were released or whether they're still in the treatment center?
Yes.
Besides just children being unable to locate their parents, are there parents who are unable to locate their children?
Yes. Our organization, GOAL, is providing psychosocial support to people affected by Ebola.
That was Brian Marcelu, a program manager for the nonprofit group GOAL. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Freetown, Sierra Leone. Today is Monday, November 24th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Daybreak Africa time, 17 and a half minutes past the hour. The UN African Peacekeeping Mission in Darfur, known as UNAMID, has reportedly confirmed that it has been told by the Sudan government to begin making preparations to leave the region. Sudan's Minister of Information, Ahmed Bilal, says the inability of the mission to protect itself has brought on extra responsibility for the Sudan government and military. Tensions between the Sudan government and UNAMID have been mounting since a report 2 weeks ago claimed that the Sudan army raped about 200 women in the village of Tabit, about 45 kilometers southwest of the North Darfur capital, El Fasher. Bilal says the UN mission had already investigated the claims and found them to be false. He says UNAMID was told to stop interfering in Sudan's affairs or leave the region.
In fact, actually, we asked them if they wouldn't stop interfering in our affairs, they have to leave. One reason is that the incapability of the keeping force to protect themselves. When they move, they need the army to move with them and to protect them. And their major, actually, task is to protect the people. And now they need protection for themselves.
The allegations, Mr. Minister, is that there have been some violation or crimes against some civilians in the region. And so the United Nations Secretary General has even asked your government to allow for this investigation to take place.
They did, actually. They asked for this. And because they need protection, the army went with them and they did investigations. They moved freely. No interference from the army happened. And they announced that these allegations are untrue. And they finished. After that, some people say, no, there is a heavy army presence there and this is made some sort of pressure. And they want to repeat this again. I think Any reputable country would not at all agree for such an allegations and for such things to be repeated and repeated and to be even actually mentioned like that. I myself, I sent an aeroplane with 50 journalists. They went there freely. They asked the people. There were all the women there protesting, saying this is just something which against their pride and defamation for them. Nothing had happened. According only to an allegation from a local radio there saying there was a mass rape, and they have investigated and they found nothing.
The mission of UNAMID should expire in March next year. Did your government already request that they should leave?
No. We didn't actually ask them to evacuate immediately. This is a procedure. We know it. They cannot go stuck like this. We said that if you didn't cooperate, we can end it. And we know they are offering nothing. $600 million of dollars every year comes to them. They are doing some sort of, you know, luxurious things. They import even water. Even water, which we are a country full of water, we have actually this inside that. They are importing fruits, water, meat, vegetables from outside. Why is this? I think this is an interest for some companies.
Ahmed Bilal, Sudan's information minister, he was speaking with me from the capital, Khartoum. Political fireworks are expected when Zimbabwe's ruling ZANU-PF party holds its congress in early December. The event is meant for the longtime ruling party to appoint leaders. But this year, some fear could turn into a political bloodbath as the aging president's wife tries to oust the vice president and boost her own political standing. Anita Powell sets the stage from VOA's Southern Africa Bureau in Johannesburg.
For more than 30 years, Zimbabwe's ruling party has had one unrivaled fixture, the man on top, Robert Mugabe. As President Mugabe approaches his 91st birthday, he is continuing to control his ZANU-PF party and hamstringing potential successors with a divide-and-rule strategy. The party meeting, which begins December 2nd, is likely to yield two dramatic events. One, Mr. Mugabe will promote his wife to his party's inner circle, and two, he will demote Vice President Joyce Mujuru, whose popularity is seen as a threat. Political analyst Judy Smithone of the South African Institute of International Affairs says while this Congress will follow old patterns, there have been some recent political surprises, like the meteoric political rise of Mr. Mugabe's wife, Grace.
It's going to be an interesting event this time because we have seen Grace Mugabe really rallying up and rallying against the current Vice President, Joyce Mujuru. This is not something we've seen thus far, but what we have always seen has been factionalism. There's always been factionalism within ZANU-PF. We've just not seen the First Lady step up as she has up until now. So I think that's what's caught people by surprise.
Grace Mugabe's sudden political fortunes have come with more than a little help from the president. In August, she was given the top post in ZANU-PF's Women's League. In September, her husband, who is the Chancellor of the University of Zimbabwe, capped her with a PhD in sociology, just 2 months after she enrolled in that program. The newly minted Dr. Mugabe then embarked on a rally tour of the country, praising her husband and repeatedly insulting the embattled vice president. Mrs. Mugabe seems to share her husband's knack for caustic rhetoric. Recently, the mother of four threatened, "Soon, we are going to baby dump your faction leader." Political analyst Pedzizai Ruhanya, director of the Zimbabwe Democracy Institute, decoded that statement for VOA's Zimbabwe service.
There's no doubt that the remarks by Grace Mugabe were aimed at the Vice President, Joyce Mujuru. This is the clearest indication that all she is doing in the provinces has one political objective, and that political objective is to remove the vice president as the vice president and second secretary of the ruling party.
But Smithhorn says Mrs. Mugabe's power play may have more to do with Mr. Mugabe's inevitable demise than with Mrs. Mugabe's own desire to lead. And analyst Ibo Mandaza tells VOA's Zimbabwe service that Mr. Mugabe, ever in control, may have deployed his own wife to fight his political battles. This year's event is likely to be full of political twists and turns. But through all of that, one thing is clear. The name Mugabe is still very much on top in Zimbabwe. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Mozambique has one of the world's highest rates of child marriage, driven by strong social and cultural traditions, despite the practice being illegal. As viewers Gillian Parker reports from Maputo, the African Union has pledged to stop all child marriages within a generation.
In a sandy suburb of Pemba in northern Mozambique, 16-year-old Rachel bounces her daughter on her knee before handing the fidgety toddler to her sister. Rachel, who did not want to reveal her real name and asked not to be recorded, describes how at 14 she got pregnant. "My big sister insisted that I stay in school," she tells me. "There are many here who have babies at a young age, but normally they leave school to get married and continue to have children every year after that. Some think marriage is a guarantee of security," she says. It's a familiar narrative in Mozambique, where 52% of girls marry before they are 18. Ceremonies with dancing and music mark the beginning of the mostly secretive initiation rites season in Pemba. Girls are removed from school when they have their first menstruation, sometimes before, and are kept away for days, weeks, or even months to undergo initiation by the matronas, female community elders. It is so accepted in this northern province that the school calendar has been adapted to accommodate the practice. Initiation rites prepare girls for married life in Mozambique, with training in submissiveness, domestic duties, the art of seduction, and may include female genital mutilation in the belief that it will increase male sexual pleasure. After going through initiation, girls are considered ready for marriage. Françoise Madouthe, African Regional Officer for Girls Not Brides, says child marriage often forces girls to drop out of school and to have children before their bodies are mature enough.
Most often expected to enter into sexual intercourse very early before her body is ready. She's also very often expected to have children to prove her value as a wife. And
that was viewer Gillian Parker reporting from Maputo. It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Good Monday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin at the Global Watch Summit in Johannesburg, South Africa. The two-day summit, which ended on Friday, set out to mobilize sports people, fans and other stakeholders to create a global movement aimed at ending racism and discrimination in sports. The American Professional Basketball League, NBA, which has attracted almost a third of their best players from outside the country, is a firm believer in zero tolerance for racism. NBA's Amadou Fall explains.
What matters is really the talent and the makeup of your character. At the NBA, if you've got game, we want you in our league, and we are going to make sure that you are successful. As a global brand and also looking at the popularity and the visibility of our players, we understand that we have a responsibility to be leaders in really leading the conversations on social issues. This is why when incidents happen, we don't hide. We act swiftly and decisively. To deal with that
was Senegal's Amadou Fall, the NBA representative at the Global Watch Summit, speaking in Johannesburg, South Africa. Meanwhile, the International Olympic Committee president Thomas Bach emphasized the Olympic movement's firm rejection of racism in sports. He explains.
The Olympic movement was founded by Baron Pierre de Coubertin on the belief that sport should stand for understanding, respect and dialogue. He made it clear when he stated that sport is for everyone, without distinction of birth, caste, fortune, position, or profession. There is no place for racism in sport. Sport stands for building bridges, never for erecting walls. That the global diversity of cultures, societies, and life designs is a source of riches. The Olympic Games are the culmination of this message of non-discrimination and unity in diversity.
That was Thomas Bach, the International Olympic Committee president, speaking in Johannesburg, South Africa. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. And that's it for this Monday, November 24th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stradak, as well as sports editor Mark Ullman, Along with our engineer, Jim Harmon, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you a very productive week.
Next week on Straight Talk Africa, host Shaka Sali sits down with Sarah Obama and Saeed Obama, U.S. President Barack Obama's grandmother and uncle from Kenya. She'll join him to talk about her new project, the Mama Sarah Obama Foundation. That's next time on VOA Africa.